Okay, we'll get started. First of all, Birshus Rav Miller Shlita, and Birshus all of the honored guests and family members who have come for the annual Yortzeit Shir for my father, Tzvi Ben Ephraim HaKohen, Zichrono Livracha. I very much appreciate your attention and your attendance, and I also want to acknowledge the first time appearance here in Eretz Yisrael of my wife for the annual Yortzeit Shir. Not the first time appearance ever, but the first time appearance for the annual Yortzeit Shir. It's wonderful to have my wife here as well. And of course, my mother, Shtichya. It's always a very, very special schus. So the topic for this year's Shir is the Halachic Prenuptial Agreement, the ins and the outs. I really don't know why I added the ins and the outs. I was told to come up with some sort of a catchy title. That's all I could think of. I apologize. Now, there's been much recent discussion about halachic prenuptial agreements. This includes a major movement within our community, within the broader Jewish community, to promote the utilization of halachic prenuptial agreements in order to prevent aguna situations. In other words, through the agreement itself to bring about a giving of a get whenever there's a breakdown of a marriage, so that a husband does not withhold a get, the Jewish divorce, from his wife, and thereby make her an aguna, make her a woman who is incapable of moving on with her life, and also to prevent mamzerim, because if a woman would remarry without receiving a get after being in a valid Jewish marriage, then any children from a subsequent marriage to another Jewish man would not only be prohibited, but any children who would be born would be mamzerim. So for those who did not sign prenuptial agreements, there's also been a movement for people to sign postnuptial agreements, to take the same form of agreement that is being executed by couples when they get married, and to adjust the language of the agreement so that it could be signed as a postnuptial agreement. And there have even been postnuptial agreements signing parties and events with food and music and so forth to generate the greatest possible participation of people signing these agreements. I've spoken at such events. Now, the halakhic prenuptial agreement, which we're going to describe in greater detail, is distinct from your standard financial prenuptial agreement that parties sometimes sign when they get married, particularly if it's a second marriage and the like, where there is a concern that each person should be able to keep their financial assets separate, particularly if they have separate children and the like. And that is a really a separate and distinct type of a form and agreement, so we're not going to focus upon that. But what I will say is that sometimes when a couple decides, for example, if it's a second marriage, to sign a financial prenuptial agreement, they can also incorporate the terms of the halakhic prenuptial agreement into that agreement as well. The halakhic prenuptial agreement is more akin to the tanaim. We know that when a couple gets married, they sign a ksuba, and there's also tanaim that are read at the chasen stich. They don't generally say much nowadays, but tanaim used to be a much more serious document that would be executed when a couple would get engaged, and would spell out certain obligations that they would have to not break off the engagement, for example. And it would even establish a knas, a penalty amount, that a party would have to pay to the other party if they would break off the engagement. So the difference between the Tanaim and this document is that this document also records other obligations that will continue into the marriage and don't expire at the time of the marriage, like your typical Tanaim document. There have been also other very interesting documents that were executed throughout the centuries, some of which have fallen into disuse, but which really might be worthy of reconsideration, such as a shtar chalitza document that would be signed by a brother of the chasson that would record a commitment on the part of the brother that if the chasson would, rachman al-tzlan, chas v'shalom, die without any children, and the wife would require chalitza from the brother in order to be allowed to marry somebody else, then the brother committed that he would agree to perform the chalitza without giving any trouble or without making any demands. Somebody also sent me an agreement this past year from the Bezdin Hamiyucha, the Takana Sagunas Belishka Merkazis Beizor Habriti Begermania in Germany, a form of prenuptial agreement that was signed in the displaced persons camps after World War II, in which a husband who was getting married to a new wife and who presumptively lost his wife in the Holocaust, but doesn't have firm proof that she died, commits to this Beis Din that if the wife whom he presumes to be dead should ever show up, that he would submit his situation to this Beis Din, and he would abide by whatever their instructions were in terms of whether he needed to divorce his new wife, go back to his old wife, whether he'd be allowed to be with either one of them, and whatever they would require of him, he would follow their instructions. But this halakhic prenuptial agreement is different from those, so far as the main focus of the halakhic prenuptial agreement that we're going to discuss, primarily the form, which I made some copies of, that was promulgated by the Beis Din of America, is specifically geared to ensure that if there is a breakdown of the marriage, that the parties will appear before the Beis Din, if there's a dispute regarding the giving of a get, and that if it's appropriate for a get to be given, that there be steps in place that will ensure that a get is given in a proper and timely fashion so that the parties can move on with their lives. For a long time, in the newspaper that we're all familiar with, the Jewish press, I grew up with the Jewish press, they had a quote in every single week's issue. They would have a couple of pages devoted to aguna issues, and they had a quote from me that said, in 100% of divorce cases where the prenuptial agreement was duly executed by the parties, a get was given in a timely fashion. And that's a pretty good statistic of 100% of the cases. I think that statistic is basically still accurate, although I believe that there was one case that had not yet been resolved through the prenup, and the parties decided to resolve the issues through different channels. But whether the statistic is currently 100% or 99.9%, it's still a pretty compelling statistic. And in addition, there's a letter, a 2012 letter that I also duplicated in the materials that were circulated, that's signed by 24 YU Rosh Yeshiva. And this letter states, that the Rosh Yeshiva all agree that halakhic prenuptial agreements should become standard throughout the Jewish community for all engaged couples. The RCA even passed a resolution a couple of years ago, essentially requiring all of its rabbis to insist upon the signing of a halakhic prenuptial agreement whenever officiating at a wedding. There's also been a recent movement to push for the utilization of the halakhic prenuptial agreement in the Haredi community, which has also seen its share of problems of aguna cases, including some high-profile ones. I sat at a meeting with a major leader of the Lakewood Yeshiva and other parties in that individual's office. That's probably as explicit as I'm allowed to be. And there was a very serious discussion at that time. This was a couple of years ago, about really pushing for the acceptance of the agreement within the Haredi community. And there have been a number of high-level conversations within that community over the past couple of years about this as well. The agreement is widely viewed as the most effective tool to curtail the aguna problem. And in Chicago, the Dayan of Agudat Yisrael, my colleague, Rabbi and mentor, Rabbi Shmuel First Shlita, has explicitly and expressly indicated his support for the prenuptial agreement, especially, as he put it, since the older methods of breaking the husband's arms and the like have landed some rabbis in jail, so there is no other better alternative. And yet, at the same time, there has also been some pushback and opposition, particularly coming from Eretz Yisrael in recent years. This is complicated because not every halakhic prenuptial agreement is the same. The most standard form, as I mentioned, is the Beis Din of America agreement, but there have also been additional forms circulating in Israel, including the Haskem Kavod HaDadi, which was formulated by Rachel Levmore, in consultation with various individuals in the Beis Din world, including myself at the time. She used to have an office in the Beis Din HaRabbani Center here on Kanfei Nesharim, and she also consulted with Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, but never received a written haskama from him regarding that agreement. One interesting aspect of that agreement, which is generally signed in Hebrew, is that there is also an English translation of the agreement, and on the English translation, there's a one-page addendum that transfers the jurisdiction to the Beit Din of America in the event that one party should move outside of Israel, and would convert the agreement to become the Beit Din of America prenuptial agreement at that point in time. There's also a Tzohar, a prenuptial agreement as well. So if you see opposition by some rabbis to one agreement, it does not necessarily denote opposition to other agreements. And sometimes there is, however, a tendency to throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, so that if there is a concern that it's not a good idea in Israel, an individual is condemning the Israeli prenuptial agreements, it just is more convenient to condemn the American prenuptial agreement as well, which is unfortunate. But at the same time, what you'll also notice is that there were many more endorsements of the American Beit Din of America halakhic prenuptial agreement, and not really rabbinic endorsements, and not explicit rabbinic endorsements of the Israeli agreements. And in certain cases, those who critique the Israeli agreement do not critique the American agreement, and we'll try to explain the reason for that as well. So now let's discuss, as the title indicates, the ins and the outs. What works and what doesn't? What's in and what's out? So, of course, the original classic prenuptial agreement is the ksuba. The ksuba that everybody signs at the time of their wedding. The Rambam explains, based on the Gemara, it's in the source one here, Hilchos Ishus Perek Yod, Shlote Kala Beinav Lahotzia. The ksuba, the amount of the ksuba, was this that we generally assume is rabbinic in nature. It was meant to protect the marriage, so that a husband who might precipitously divorce his wife, otherwise it used to be, before Rabbeinu Gershom came along 1,000 years ago, it used to be a husband could divorce his wife against her will. So in order that he not divorce her too precipitously, he was required to pay a certain amount of money, a certain amount of zuzim, zakukim, upon the divorce, and that would serve to discourage him from terminating a marriage that was otherwise viable and functional. So this was meant to protect the marriage, but it also was meant to memorialize a husband's obligations to take care of his wife. And in fact, the Gemara in Ksuvah, Daf Nun Zayin, says, Asal Adam Lihisho Simishto Apil Shachas Blo Ksuvah. Man is not allowed to live with his wife even 1 minute without a Ksuvah. That's why I sometimes get frantic calls in the middle of the night. A couple discovers that they lost the Ksuvah and they need a replacement Ksuvah. It's called the Ksuvah de Erkasa, as quickly as possible, so that they will be allowed to remain with each other. It's a big deal. So technically, a ksuba could be an anti-aguna tool if the husband doesn't want to pay the financial obligations that he's obligated to pay pursuant to the ksuba. Ve'ezon v'afarnes, he's obligated to take care and support of his wife. So if the Beis Din would say, either perform those obligations or else give your wife a get, that could be an effective tool. But practically speaking, the ketubah is rarely enforced. And even when the ketubah is enforced, it's generally only after the get is given or the husband dies, when the wife needs to or wants to collect the lump sum payment that is mentioned in the ketubah that she's entitled to upon death or divorce, the 200 zuz plus the 200 zukukim of silver that are described in the ksuba. So also, from an enforcement perspective, if the parties haven't agreed to give a Beis Din enforcement power, where are you going to enforce the ksuba? If you go to a secular court in America to enforce the ksuba, they'll say, we have no idea what zuzim are, and we have no idea what zukukim are, and that would require a religious interpretation that we are not allowed to perform, so we're not going to enforce this. There was a case like that called In Re White, where a woman tried to enforce the ksuba, and the court did not allow her to do so. But even in a Beis Din, it's very rare that parties come to enforce the unspecified amounts of support during the marriage, because those amounts are not indicated in the ksuba. The ksuba just gives the amounts to pay after the divorce or after the husband's death. So we only had one case that I remember in all my years at Beis Din in which a wife in a current marriage brought the husband to Beis Din to provide her with more support over the course of the marriage. Obviously, the marriage was a little bit on shaky grounds, and one of the problems was that the husband was siphoning away too much of his money to pay the maximum amount in his pension fund, and there was nothing left to spend on just basic needs for themselves and the kids. So based on the language in the Ksuba that says the husband undertakes to pay Kihilchos Guvan Yudayin, the Mefanasin Yisgidei Yasashayin Bekushta, the line that says that the husband undertakes that he is going to support his wife in the manner of Jewish husbands, Bekushta, in truth and with integrity. So he said integrity requires that you contribute less funds in your pension account every single year, and we sent them away. As far as I know, they are still married to each other. But that's the only case that I remember. But nonetheless, there was an idea that was proposed to Rav Moshe Feinstein by his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Tendler Shlita, the Rav of our family, the Rav of my father, Zichrono Livracha. And Rabbi Tendler advanced the idea, why don't we just translate the Ksuba in order to resolve Aguna situations? So Rav Moshe Feinstein, Eben Ezra, Chelek Dalet, Simon Tzadi, says that's a really good idea. To translate into English, you make it enforceable, have the party sign it themselves, so a secular court will recognize it. You're going to translate the notion of support of what the husband has to pay to the wife. So he says that this will very much help. This will help to prevent aguna situations, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. So why isn't this form more widely utilized? This was the form that was signed when I got married to my wife. This is the prenuptial agreement, Mindy, that we have. Naturally, because Rabbi Tendler was our Masada Kiddushin, so we used his prenuptial agreement. Don't tell anybody, other than those who listen to this year online, we didn't actually sign the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement, but we did sign a valid halachic the prenuptial agreement. So why is that not good enough? So Rabbi Mordechai Willig has noted that the ksuva obligation by itself is not an absolute obligation. For example, if the wife decides that she's going to leave the husband, she'll be a moredis, she's going to make the unilateral decision to break up the marriage, she is not entitled to the payment under the ksuva. So therefore, it doesn't cover all eventualities. And if there's a machlokis, there's a dispute between the husband and the wife over who is responsible for the wife moving out. This is in Eben Ezer, Simon Ayin, Sif Yud Beis in the Shulchan Aruch. So then the Beis Shmuel rules that the burden of proof is upon the wife, not upon the husband. So therefore, she does not automatically receive support in such a case, and the husband then doesn't have an automatic motivation to give a get in order to get out of having to provide support. So then there was another version of prenuptial agreement suggested by Robert Salo Jolti. It was published in the journal Pardes Koveres Zion, where he bases himself on a case in the Gemara. The Gemara says if a husband gives a get in a faulty fashion to his wife, so that she might be divorced, but she might not be divorced. We call Migureshes, Veina Migureshes, she's in limbo, then he's obligated to support her. So he said, well, every single case where a woman has a civil divorce, where there's a divorce proceeding between husband and wife, let's say in America, and there's a civil divorce, but there isn't yet a get, she's in limbo. And therefore, he's automatically obligated to support her, and that should be recorded in the prenuptial agreement. However, as Rabbi Bleich points out, that's not necessarily true. Because in the event that the civil divorce was issued based on the wife's filing of the divorce, if she unilaterally decided to break up the marriage, then according to halacha, it does not automatically follow that she is entitled to support from her husband. So therefore, the thought was that even Rabbi Bezalel Jolti's prenuptial agreement was not an ideal solution because it required a payment by the husband when it was not necessarily required by halacha. If you require the husband to pay money, when it's not required by halacha, so, and he gives a get to avoid that obligation, that is generally viewed as a coerced get. You say to somebody, give money, you're not really obligated to give, or in order to get out of it, give your wife a get. So that's considered akin to holding a gun to the husband's head and saying, we're going to pull the trigger unless you give your wife a get. It was saying, we're going to require you to pay money that halakhically you're not obligated to pay unless you give a get. So therefore, that's problematic. So then Rav Moshe Feinstein has another form of prenuptial agreement, which is simply an arbitration agreement. It has nothing to do with money, nothing to do with support. It just says that you'll have an agreement, Shem Yavoli De Piru, this is in Eben Ezra, Chelek Dalet Siman Kuf Zayin, Miyavoli De Piru, Lo Yakim Litein Get Peturin, that in the event that there's a separation between the husband and the wife, so then they agree that they're going to appear before a particular bezdin, and in the event that the bezdin rules that the husband has to give a get, he agrees to give it. And if the bezdin rules that the wife has to receive a get, she agrees to receive it. And he says, this is wonderful. This is permissible. A get lo yet get meusa, and it will not be considered to be a coerced get. So therefore, Rav Moshe approves of this solution. What does this solution accomplish? It causes the parties to show up before the bezdin. Because in America, unlike Israel, we have a problem with jurisdiction. And the Israeli Bat Din have automatic jurisdiction over all of their residents, over all of the Jewish citizens of the state. They can always summon the husband to come to the bezdin whenever the wife wants to get, and then they can deliberate over his obligation. But in America, we don't have automatic jurisdiction. And if a wife wants to summon the husband to come to bezdin, he can say, this is a free country, I can do whatever I want, I don't need to go to the rabbinical court. So this arbitration agreement signed by the parties, which is enforceable by a secular court as well, says that if the parties sign on the dotted line when they get married, that if there's ever a dispute about the get, they'll go in front of the bezdin and do whatever the bezdin says. So this is enforceable by a secular court. And therefore, this is a viable agreement from a halakhic perspective as well, because it causes the husband to show up. And as we know, from an individual I'm not going to quote, 90% of success in life is showing up. So here, 90% of success in averting aguna situations is getting the husband to show up. So by virtue of signing this agreement, you get the husband to show up. I remember I had a case once where they signed only the arbitration agreement, and the husband ran off to the Netherlands, and the wife brought a lawyer in the Netherlands who showed this agreement to the court over there, and the court said, you're obligated to the husband, you're obligated to appear before the bezdin of America to take care of the get matter, and therefore he called us up and said, okay, what do I need to do to take care of the get? And that was good enough to resolve the get issue and to get the husband to give his wife a get. However, in the event that the bezdin says the husband has to give the get and he doesn't listen to the bezdin, what happens then? If this is only an agreement to adjudicate the issue of the get, but it doesn't have further teeth, it doesn't give the bezdin the ability to impose a monetary obligation upon the husband, nor would there, let's say, be a halakhic basis for imposing a monetary obligation, so then it doesn't necessarily resolve every single case either. In fact, as Rabbi Willig pointed out, if you have a knas, let's say that you have a penalty which is imposed by the court because the bezdin said the husband's obligated to give a get, and the court says to the husband, therefore we're going to fine you $1,000 a day until you give a get, that's still problematic. That would still be problematic from a halakhic perspective. If the bezdin's able to issue a decree that we have the right to compel the man to give a get, which in certain cases we do, but most cases we don't, so then we have a Mishnah that says that a secular court can say to the man, do what the bezdin is requiring you to do. The bezdin says that we can whip you, so we're going to whip you, you know, on their behalf. But if the bezdin didn't say that the man can be whipped, just that he has to give a get, so then this is not a simple and an always effective solution either. In addition, the identity of the arbitrator is very, very important. Moshe's agreement works when you name the right bezdin. You have to name a bezdin that is really capable of understanding the halakhic issues and issuing a correct psak. One of the earliest forms of prenuptial agreement, one of the outs, shall we say, was the conservative movement prenuptial agreement, which had a Lieberman clause. What was the Lieberman clause? The Lieberman clause was a clause in the ketubah in the English translation of the Ketubah, it was also in the Hebrew version, that said that if there's ever going to be a dispute between the parties, they agree that they're going to submit to the arbitration or the decision-making of the conservative rabbinical court. So people didn't like that clause. There were several reasons they didn't like it. One was because they felt the Ksuba is sacrosanct and don't put extraneous clauses in the Ksuba. I don't know if that's necessarily such a big deal. The Sephardic Ksuba has all kinds of additional clauses. But the other concern was that the conservative Beis Din might impose penalties upon the husband that are not warranted according to halakha, so a get that would be given would not be valid. And finally, if they would administer the get, they weren't necessarily going to be trusted in all Orthodox circles to be able to administer and supervise a kosher get. However, if you have a reputable Beis Din that is named in an arbitration clause to resolve any get disputes, it goes a really long way towards resolving aguna problems. And in fact, this particular component of requiring arbitration in front of a Beis Din was one of the major reasons why certain poskim were very much in favor of the American version of the halakhic prenuptial agreement, because it accomplishes this. Because if you think about it, in America, one of the major problems is that Beis Din doesn't have enough authority. People complain in Israel that Beis Din has too much authority. But in America, the complaint was that they don't really, but that's the complaint. But the complaint in America was that the Beis Din simply doesn't have the authority. And this agreement gave the Beis Din the authority. So that was a major reason that Rav Zalman Nechem Yagol, for example, was very supportive of the idea of the American Beis Din of America halakhic prenuptial agreement, because it brings parties to Beis Din as opposed to civil court. If you look at the Beis Din of America agreement, it even includes options where the parties say, we're not only going to submit to the Beis Din with respect to any dispute regarding get matters, but we'll submit to the Beis Din with respect to all monetary disputes, allocation of marital assets, spousal support, child custody. Anything that needs to be litigated will be litigated in Beis Din as opposed to being litigated in civil court. But in Israel, where Beis Din didn't automatically have jurisdiction, and they automatically have broad powers to do things to husbands who are supposed to give a get and don't give a get, so the critique of some of the Israeli Beis Din was that they were accomplishing exactly the opposite. They weren't saying that whatever obligations, monetary obligations and the like, that would be specified in the agreement should be carried out by the Beis Din of Rabbanim. They would say things like, well, it should go to a guf shiputi. It should go to some sort of court that has jurisdiction, with the implication that if somebody races to Bagatz, if they would race to the secular court first, because in Israel it's a race to the courthouse, if either spouse races to the civil court first, so they would adjudicate the monetary issues of the divorce, so then it would be up to the civil secular courts to adjudicate the provisions of the agreement. And that would help us understand why the Rabbanim were not as gung-ho about the Israeli versions that have been formulated of the halakhic prenuptial agreement. The Tzohar agreement doesn't talk about guf shiputi, but it talks about going to a borer, going to some other type of adjudicative body outside of the rabbinut system. And therefore, that's something which causes more circumspection and more wariness from an Israeli rabbinut perspective in any event. There's a wonderful explanation of this in a recent article that was authored by Amichai Rojiner. It's in the Mishpatim Journal of Tufshin Ayin Ches, that explains on this basis, this is why the American halakhic prenuptial agreement enjoys, by and large, greater support than the Israeli prenuptial agreement, because the American agreement brings people to Beis Din, while the Israeli agreement ostensibly does not support enough of a vote of confidence in the ability of the Beis Din to get the job done. What does enjoy? I'm sorry?
Israeli, do you mean the Levmore?
I mentioned two different agreements. There is the Rocha Levmore agreement, and then there is as well the Tzohar agreement. The Tzohar agreement is a different variation of that idea. So what generally enjoys border support, even in Israel, is agreements to mediate. For example, if you have an agreement between the parties to mediate, where they're just signing that if there is a breakdown in the marriage, then they will appear before before some type of a mediator body, not an alternative bezdin to the Rabbanut, but somebody who's going to try to mediate their marital issues, maybe even bring about shalom bayis, and otherwise try to reach an amicable resolution of the issues. So this is something that David Meshulov has developed and that has enjoyed a little bit more support. But if a resolution is not reached, so then it is also not something that ultimately would be able to resolve an aguna situation necessarily. However, it is consistent, if you think about it, with what a number of poskim have mentioned over the years, which is that we don't really precipitously want to terminate or bring an end to any marriage anyway. But Moshe Feinstein speaks about not going to the last step of requiring a get until you've had at least 12 months of a couple trying to work out their differences. Chaim Pelagi speaks about an 18-month period. So sometimes we get the question, why is it that in the American prenuptial agreement, unlike if you look at the Israeli versions that generally incorporate some notion of trying to work things out, why is it that we don't have this prerequisite of a first requiring 12 months or 18 months of trying to work things out prior to enforcing the terms of the prenuptial agreement? So I think that in America, there are so many aguna cases, and there are so many cases where people run off and they can get married without a get, just in the standard American courts, and have a mamzerim, that imposing a waiting period would come at too high a cost from an American perspective. And in any event, the reality is that the couples generally have been separated for at least that long before their case becomes a full-fledged Bezdin case. And of course, if there is a chance of restoring Shalom Bayis, then we're all in favor of it. And of course, we would try to steer the parties in that direction. But Moshe's other concern was not to create marital tensions at the outset of the marriage. But nowadays, there's much more of an awareness by couples when they get married of the possibility of divorce. Unfortunately, it's just much more in the air. And secondly, as it becomes more conventional and standardized for people to sign the prenuptial agreement, it also becomes less personal, like the signing of the ksuba, so it does not cast the same pall upon the inception of the marriage. So the novelty of the Beis Din of America agreement really is that it has two components. It has the arbitration component, and it also has a support component. It also has an undertaking by the husband that in the event that the couple will be separated at any point in time, the husband will support his wife for a certain amount of money every single day, as long as they are still married according to Jewish law. So this is, in a way, much more sweeping and more easily enforceable than the ksuva, because it's an absolute obligation. The husband waives any rights he might have to his wife's earnings during this period of time. He waives any insistence that his wife provide companionship on a conjugal level with him during this time, and it's just an absolute obligation that he has to pay until such time as the parties come to Beis Din. Beis Din issues a decision of what should happen going forward. Yes get, no get, they should stay together, they shouldn't stay together. And only if the wife refuses to cooperate with the Beis Din process or with the decision of the Beis Din does the obligation terminate. So this sounds like it's really good. And in fact, it's endorsed. It was endorsed by Rav Avadya Yosef and by Rav Yitzchak Libes, the Abbesdin of the Igor Rabbanim in Brooklyn, of blessed memory. It's also endorsed Yibad L'Chaim Tovim by Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shlita, by Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg Shlita, by Rav Chaim Zimbalist, and by Rav Asher Weiss. Has a nice roster of haskamos. That's pretty good. So what could be wrong? The prenuptial agreement, I used to keep a log when I was the director of the Beis Din of America, and I left that post 11 years ago. When I left that post, I had a log of 200 cases where a get was given in a timely fashion because the couples had signed a halakhic prenuptial agreement. Now it's 11 years later. You can only imagine how many hundreds and hundreds of cases have been more easily resolved because the couple signed the halakhic prenuptial agreement. It's like putting on a seatbelt as you go into the roller coaster of marriage. Something like that. But what could be the criticism according of the halakhic prenuptial agreement? So any monetary agreement of support has to avoid two issues. One issue is asmachta. Asmachta is, there are many ways to define it, but for our purposes, we'll call it a conditional obligation. When somebody says they're going to pay money only if something happens, so we say there might not be sufficient gemiras das, asmachta lo kanya. Generally speaking, if a person enters into a conditional obligation, so they might think this condition is never going to happen, I'll never be obligated to pay, so they don't have a sufficient commitment for it to be enforceable. That's an asmachta problem. The second problem is knas, that if the husband is going to obligate himself to pay money when he might not otherwise be halakhically obligated, maybe it's a penalty clause. It's a penalty clause, so then if he gives a get to avoid it, so maybe that's considered to be a coerced get. Now, it's important to remember, you could theoretically avoid the asmachta issue, but still have a knas issue. You might say that it's a valid commitment in terms of the enforceability, but by enforcing it, it's going to be a penalty, and therefore it's going to create a coerced get, a get me'usa. So how do you get out of these issues? So in order to get out of the asmachta issue, it's a really long discussion. I recommend that you read all the articles that Rabbi Bleich has written on the subject, you review Rabbi Willig's thoughts on the subject. Bottom line is, if you look at the sources you can, according to the major authorities, the Machaber and the Rama and the Shulchan Aruch, if you have a combination of two different features, you can generally get out of an asmachta problem. One feature is if the person says the obligation may achshav. I may not have to pay it until later, but may achshav, I undertake that I'm right now that I am obligated to pay this amount. It may be suspended for a period of time, but may achshav, right from this moment, I obligate to pay myself at this amount. That's component number one. And some say that only works if you're transferring, if you say that you're going to transfer a specific item at a specific time rather than you're going to assume an obligation to pay money at a certain time. That's part of the debate. And there are proofs in both directions. And then the second component is that the person agrees that he's going to undertake the obligation in front of a Beis Din Chashuv, in front of an esteemed Beis Din. So I have couples that come to me at the Chicago Rabbinical Council, they sign the agreement in our offices. It doesn't get more esteem than that, obviously, so we don't have any issue in that regard. But not always do people sign the agreement in the offices of a Beis Din Chashuv. So then, how is this provision going to be honored? So the Rama writes that the husband or the person who is undertaking the obligation says, I'm making a hodas bal din. I am admitting that I am undertaking this obligation in front of an esteemed Beis Din. That's good enough, because an admission is considered as if you have 100 witnesses, hodas bal din gmei edim dami, that you have done what you said that you are doing. So the husband says, I'm undertaking the obligation in front of a Beis Din. Chashuv is considered equivalent to actually appearing before a Beis Din Chashuv. So therefore, the Beis Din of America agreement has both of those components. And if you want to argue, no, Beis Din Chashuv means the Beis Din has to be engaged in it, or the Beis Din or the husband has to really understand his rights, technically speaking, he is only making an admission, but it really otherwise wouldn't be binding. If you want to object along these lines, so Razam and Nechem Yugoberg threw in another argument, which is that any kind of undertaking in terms of a commitment at the inception of marriage doesn't require as many formalities in order to be binding. This is the Gemara in Kiddushin Daf Tesav and Beis. Amdu v'kishu hein hein adrama niknim ba'amira. That when it comes to negotiations at the inception of a marriage, so even if people just talk it out and there isn't a full-fledged transaction that is conducted, or a full-fledged kinyan that is performed, nonetheless, it would still be binding upon the parties. So the other issue is the issue that I think more poskim are concerned about, and that is the issue of knas, of penalty. The Rama brings a machlokas at Evanez, a Simon Kuf Lam and Dalet, as to whether if the husband imposes a knas, a penalty upon himself. He says, I will give a get to my wife, and not only that, but I will agree that I will pay $1,000 a day for every day that I don't give a get to my wife. Nobody imposed the penalty upon him. He took the penalty upon himself. The husband imposes the penalty upon himself, and then he gives a get to get out of the penalty. Is that a valid get or not? So the Ramah quotes two opinions. The Marik says it's good. The Rashba says it's bad. So says the Ramah, some say it's good, some say it's bad. Don't do it. But if you did it, b'di'evid, it's okay. And that's the opinion of the Ritva. So some say, okay, b'di'evid, it's all right. We want to prevent aguna situations. Let's rely upon that. B'di'evid, the husband here is accepting upon himself a penalty. That'll be good enough. But you don't really want to make a takana. You don't really want it to promulgate an agreement to be used by everybody based on something which is only a b'di'evid, something which is only good after the fact. So there is a form that the Bezdin of America was really relying upon in terms of the husband assuming an obligation to pay marital support every day of separation. That comes from the Nakla Shiva. Nakla Shiva was a, for those of you who are lawyers, there are Bloomberg forms for lawyers, like standard lawyer forms of different transactions. The Nakla Shiva was like the Bloomberg for halakhic forms. So he has standardized halakhic forms. The Nakla Shiva, 300 years ago plus, had a standardized halakhic form that says that it's called Tanayim Achronim, signed right before the wedding, prenuptial agreement, that says in the event of Katata, there'll be a fight, never happens, right, in the fight between husband and wife, and then they're separated from each other, so husband agrees that he'll pay a certain amount of rubles every single day until they appear before the Bezdin, and then the Bezdin will restore marital harmony. The Nakla Shiva seems to assume that, of course, the Bezdin's going to restore marital harmony. So there's no mention whatsoever about a get, and no clear indication that this marital support obligation was connected to trying to avoid a guna situation. So it's just the husband's agreeing to pay this amount every day of separation. So it's difficult to utilize it as a clear precedent, because it was not designed on its face to address aguna situations. And also, there's an opinion of another commentator named the Maharshtam. The Maharshtam has a tshuva of an Ezra Siman Sama Gimel, in which he says that in a case where a husband knows that the wife wants a get, and he takes upon himself a penalty if he doesn't give the get, that might be okay. But if the husband never knows this is going to happen, he just says, I will assume a penalty in the event there's ever a fight between myself and my wife, and I'll submit it to a certain arbitrator, and if the arbitrator imposes a penalty upon me, then I will pay it. But he does this. So then, says the Maharshtam, that for sure is not enforceable, because the husband, at the time that he signed the agreement, never thought that there would be a penalty imposed upon him. So that's worse than when the husband definitely imposes the penalty upon him. I'm sorry? So then you go back a little bit in terms, let's say you've avoided the asmakta problem. Even if you have avoided the asmakta problem, you still have this penalty problem on the part of the husband that he didn't expect that it would necessarily go into effect. And finally, you also have the opinion of the Mishkanos Yaakov, quoted by the Piskei Tshuva, who says that really there's no argument about a self-imposed penalty, that in the event that at the time the husband gives the get, he says, I really wouldn't want to give the get other than the penalty. Everybody agrees that that doesn't really work. And finally, there's another objection based on a tshuva by the Mabit, that says that if the husband doesn't have the means to pay the amount that he took upon himself, even as a self-imposed penalty, because he took upon himself $1,000 a day, and he can only really afford $15 a day or $100 a day, so then that also would not pass the smell test, and that would be invalid according to everybody. So what is the answer? How do you address these various problems in terms of the Knas issue? So the answer very simply is that the Bezdin of America agreement was specifically geared to avoid this problem because the amount is reasonable. It's not a knas. The amount is a normal amount that a husband is expected to pay for the support of his wife. We actually did a study. We had somebody go out to all of the major communities where Jews live in America to see what is the standard cost of living in terms of food, clothing, and shelter that a person needs to get by every single year. And the amount, the standard amount that is stated in the agreement, $150 a day, comes out to about $54,000 a year. might seem like a lot. By Israeli standards, by American standards, really not all that much. By American standards, this is completely reasonable. Additionally, the Bez in America agreement utilizes, as I mentioned, this opinion of the Torah's Gittin, Rabbi Yaakov Melissa, who says that the husband also can waive his rights to his wife's earnings and any other commitments or obligations of the wife towards her husband, and to simply maintain his support obligation. So Avosha Weiss, in his endorsement of the prenuptial agreement, says this is wonderful. It has nothing to do with knas, nothing to do with penalty. All that the agreement really does is that it reallocates the burden of proof. If there is a dispute between the husband and wife who's really responsible, whether the wife is responsible, the husband is responsible, it says as a default proposition, the husband has to pay until it can be proven otherwise, which he says is perfectly reasonable, because why should we place the burden of proof on the woman? It's not right to force a woman to go to court anyway. Let her, you know, live her life peacefully. So this was a very big deal to Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg as well, who said that you have to make it clear it's just a regular support obligation and it's not linked to the get. You don't say he support, the husband agrees to support his wife until he gives her a get. No, the way to do it is we say the husband agrees he'll support his wife once they separate, as long as they're still married according to Jewish law. Nothing about a get, nothing about a get. But it follows that if he wants to get out of the support obligation, it might be a good idea to no longer be married according to Jewish law. How are you no longer married according to Jewish law? By giving a get. The other concern, however, which was raised by Rav Moshe Sternbuch in a tshuva that he wrote a couple of years ago, is that he thought that the amount was astronomical. He said, let's say $150. He thought, by definition, $150. He's thinking of, you know, Haredi living standards, you know, here in Yerushalayim, $150 a day. Of course that's a knas. Of course that's a penalty amount. That's much more than what anybody would pay for a standard support. So this was a question, when I have been contacted by the Israeli Dayanim, this is the question that they ask me about. They say, let's say you have a husband whose standard of living is lower than the $150 a day. Do you adjust the amount in that case? So the thought process always, from the Beis Din perspective, was that the standard is based upon ola imo veino yoredes imo. It's based on the higher of either what the woman's standard of living was before she married her husband, or what the husband's standard of living is that the wife is now allowed to benefit from. But if, according to either standard, the amount would be less than $150 a day, that's the idea of why you have the parties go in front of the Beis Din, for the Beis Din to adjudicate the case. So when Beis Din adjudicates the case, they may determine that the amount really should be adjusted. So they said, but wait a second, where does it say that in your actual agreement? The actual agreement just says $150 a day. There's a reason the actual agreement just says $150 a day, and that is because, by and large, in America, it's always going to be a reasonable amount. And if you don't have a set amount in the agreement, if it's not going to be firm and fixed, then it's going to be much less effective in terms of its enforceability and in terms of the amount of importance and the amount of respect that somebody will have for the terms of the agreement. But the feeling was that this should be made more explicit. So we figured out a way to preserve the predictability of the amount, which will make sense 99.9% of the time based on our experience. But it also included flexibility language. So it says now that every now and then we'll add a couple of words to the prenuptial agreement just to make it a little bit better, a little bit more precise, a little bit more perfect. For example, we had a case where the husband was always willing to give his wife a get. They separated. And the expectation was they would try to reconcile. The wife never asked for a get. 6 months later, she asked for a get and said, oh, by the way, I want all the back pay for the previous 6 months that I was entitled to support. And the husband said, you never asked for it. Had you asked for it for one day, I would have given you a get immediately. So the case was brought to the Beis Din. And Rabbi Willig ruled that as based on the Shulchan Aruch, Ebenezer, Siman Ayin, Sif Yud Beis, also in the materials, He ruled that for every single day that a wife doesn't ask for support, she waives the support. But she said that's not what the agreement says. The agreement just says that as once we're separated, the husband agrees that he's going to pay that amount of support. So she appealed Rabbi Willig's decision in the secular court, in the Court of Appeals for Maryland. And the Court of Appeals for Maryland ruled in favor of Rabbi Willig. And one of their arguments was that this is really intended just to prevent aguna situations. And as soon as the wife asked for the get, the husband gave her the get. And he pointed to the instruction sheet of the prenuptial agreement that said this is intended to prevent aguna situations. So we realized that we needed to change the language to say the wife doesn't collect until she provides notice to the husband that she wants to collect. So we added that clause, which was fortunate because we also had to take out the other clause, because Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg and Tavshin Samachay turned to Rabbi Willig and turned to us and said, what's this that I see in your instruction sheet saying this is intended to prevent aguna situations? Then there's a chance that you're actually linking the support obligation with the get, which you're not supposed to do. You got to take out that line. So we took out the line. At the same time, we took out the other line. So therefore, it was a wash. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, we're covered. We're covered either way. So what we did in the language that we added right now is that we made it clear that the husband's obligation is circumscribed. It says, I obligate to support my wife according to the requirements of Jewish law. And then we say that that amount is going to be at the rate of $150 per day in lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support. And then we add the words, as here and above, cited and circumscribed, making it clear that it's circumscribed, that the Beis Din can decide that they're going to circumscribe that amount so that in an appropriate case, if they need to lower it in order to satisfy the requirements of Jewish law, they'll be able to satisfy the requirements of Jewish law. This way we don't have to change the amount, so nobody needs to panic, but the language protects the halakhic standing and acceptability of the agreement so that it's a win-win situation. Yes?
How do you solve the problem of child support?
Child support is a totally different issue. You can deal with the issue of the get, that's one issue, and you also deal with the issue of child support. That's a separate obligation. So what we provided in the agreement is an option for parties to go to the Beis Din to resolve all of their issues. One very important aspect of the agreement is that it does not encourage anybody going to civil court, and quite the contrary, says we want people to come to Beis Din, and we want you to bring as many aspects of the divorce dispute into Beis Din as possible. And then, of course, if we have to deal with child support, we deal with child support. So just the last few minutes, Rav, yes?
You mentioned before the shiur that Moshe Feinstein had a problem with, that it makes divorce, you know, you're just to wait 12 months, and this sort of moves things quicker, right? You mentioned,
what we said is that we don't have an explicit mention of any waiting period in our agreement, right. And I gave you an explanation for that.
There's a proof potentially to that you're based in is, there's a Gemara I learned in Moed Katan that says you can write a divorce in Chol Moed, and the Gemara asks, but doesn't it cause the woman sar? So the Gemara's answer is, well, once he put his eyes on her to divorce her, then it isn't sar, it's already sealed. So wouldn't that counter a little bit what Ramosh is saying in a way? Because I'm saying, no, it's not a time thing, it's a mental state.
When it's clear that the marriage is over, it's clear that the marriage is over.
Look,
the truth of the matter is that we certainly, none of these things are etched in stone.
Right.
Of course, it's a good idea to try to save a marriage if you can't save a marriage. I tell people all the time, I have presided over maybe 4,000 divorces over the past 20 years, but I'm not a fan of divorce. I believe in trying to save marriages if they can be saved. Sure, but sometimes you can't save a marriage and you have to make sure that you do the get as quickly as possible. There's no question about it. So Vavel Yashiv at one point in time voiced four possible concerns regarding the prenuptial agreement through his secretary, Rabbi Morgenstern at the time. One was, isn't this a knas? Isn't this a penalty? Or are we forcing the husband to give the get? So the answer is, if you do it as a support obligation, you get out of that problem. One was, isn't this an asmachta problem? So you do it in a way where it's me'akshim in front of a Beis Din Chashuv, and we can get out of the asmachta problem. Hodas Baal Din, admission that it's in front of a Beis Din Chashuv. Third problem was maybe the husband doesn't understand what he's signing. So this is important, even from a secular perspective, that the agreement should be signed signed a couple of weeks or at least a week or so before the wedding, so that there's a chance to really understand what they're signing. But if you look in Choshen Mishpat Siman Samach Aleph, the halacha is that once a person signs an agreement, it's assumed that they understand what they're signing. Even if it's in a language different from the language that they speak, it's their job to see to it that they understand exactly what they are signing. And if they claim that people misrepresented what was in the agreements, then they have to really bring witnesses regarding that misrepresentation. And the fourth concern is, isn't this going to encourage people going to secular court? And the answer is, maybe that's a concern with respect to the Israeli agreements where Rabbanut automatically has jurisdiction, and you have the question, well, why have a separate agreement? Are you trying to move this away from the Rabbanut? But in America, the objective is exactly the opposite, to move it into the domain of the Beis Din. I'll just address the last concern that you see among those who are worried about the utilization of the prenuptial agreement is, isn't this going to weaken the institution of Jewish marriage and encourage the proliferation of a divorce? So I have three basic answers. One is that there's a much greater danger of weakening a Jewish marriage to those who look for solutions where they want to do away with the giving of a get altogether. And you have, unfortunately, irresponsible individuals who go out and they tell women you could remarry without a get altogether. And that's much, much worse in terms of weakening the marital bond and the Kedushas Yisrael, the sanctity of a Jewish marriage. And especially in America, where people can run off and they can remarry without a get altogether, based on secular law. Secondly, there's a healthy perspective in signing the agreement that you're setting an example for the other person. You're not going to need it yourself, but the other person is going to need it. And if everybody signs it, so in those cases where somebody's going to really need it, so it's actually going to be there. Sometimes the other person, we have found the enemy and he is us or something. So sometimes the other person is that less honorable alter ego that lurks inside of an individual and comes out during periods of emotional distress, and by signing this agreement, a person can rescue himself against that less honorable alter ego. And finally, I think that signing the prenuptial agreement actually makes a statement more about the Kedusha, the holiness of the marital bond, akin to that of the indispensable ksuba, because it demonstrates when a husband signs it, when both parties sign it, a sense of loyalty, respect, and commitment to the other spouse, never to hold them hostage. So, Yiratzon, it's my wish and prayer that we should not have any more aguna situations, but only happy marriages, like that, by the way, of my parents, who were married for 50 years, happily, and remained committed and devoted to each other until my father's patira, and they remain bonded together to this very day, b'kedusha u'be'ava. May my father's memory be a blessing and a melitz yosher for all of us and for all of Klal Yisrael, and thank you very much for coming.